Oh, do I start?
You start, yes.
Oh, sorry. Okay, well, hello. This is about Emily Dickinson. Did we mention that? Okay, so let's start off with a poem. As you probably know, none of her poems had titles. So she was very ahead of her time in that way. Anyway, here we go. I cannot dance upon my toes. No man instructed me. But oftentimes, among my mind, a glee possesseth me that had I ballet knowledge, would put itself abroad in pirouette to blanch a troupe or lay a prima mad. And though I had no gown of gauze, no ringlet to my hair, nor hopped to audiences like birds, one claw upon the air, nor tossed my shape in eider balls, nor rolled on wheels of snow, till I was out of sight in sound, the house encore me so. Nor any know I, know the art I mention easy here, nor any placard boast me, it's full as opera.
That was just one of the amazing 1,789 short poems that Emily Dickinson wrote. Almost none of it, and fewer than 10, were actually published in her lifetime. But despite that, she has become, over the years, one of the most important and influential American poets of the past 150 years. She was born in 1830 in Amherst, Massachusetts. Her father was a lawyer and treasurer of Amherst College, a graduate of Yale. She had a brother who she loved very much called Austin, a year older than her, and a sister, Lavinia, 3 years younger. They lived in a large, rather grand mansion on Main Street, built by her grandfather. She had an excellent education.
For poets, I have Keats and Mr. and Mrs. Browning, and for prose, Mr. Ruskin, Sir Thomas Browne, and The Revelations.
Not bad, eh? The writers she loved included the Brontes, particularly Charlotte, Carlyle, George Eliot, and the Book of Common Prayer. And you will hear those threads coming through all her poetry. Her father was the greatest influence on her. He brought up his children in the light of a man called the Reverend John Bennett, whose book, Letters to a Young Lady, published in 1789, asserted, in a very influential book, asserted that nice young ladies should write letters, but definitely not poetry. Her father was a formidable creature, a formidable Puritan. He was capable, despite that, of surprising flashes. He was known to eat rioters' oyster suppers at the college, and he rode the fastest horse, by all accounts, in Amherst. And on one occasion, he rang the church bells to draw attention to a brilliant sunset. So he was an interesting man.
She wrote about him. His heart was pure and terrible, and I think no other like it exists.
Her mother, who was also called Emily, was quiet, passive, and submissive. That's befitted a woman in those days, pre-feminism. Emily nursed her through her long last illness when she was paralysed. Her father brought her up to be reserved, unself-assertive.
I'm nobody. Who are you? Are you nobody, too? Then there's a pair of us. Don't tell. They'd advertise, you know. How dreary to be somebody. How public, like a frog, to tell one's name, the livelong June, to an admiring bog.
She described herself in a letter she wrote to a man with whom she was beginning to form an attachment, but didn't work out, sadly.
I am small, like the wren, and my hair is bold, like the chestnut burr. My eyes like the sherry in the glass that the guest leaves.
Her much-loved brother, Austin, was humorous and outspoken, darkly handsome, with a contemptuous mouth. He was considered to be the most eligible bachelor in Amherst, and her sister-in-law and her closest friend, Susan Gilbert, was clever and worldly, but cool. Emily initially confided in her in everything and showed Susan her poems until the day came when Susan ill-advisedly had one printed, which horrified Emily.
It was robbed of me.
Only 4 poems written before she was 28 survive. Already she was becoming reclusive, scarcely ever leaving Amherst for the rest of her life. There was little actual event in her life, but it was emotionally intense. The American poet Adrian Rich, generations later, said that of for Emily.
The intense inner event, the personal and psychological, was inseparable from the universal.
Aged 18, Emily met someone called Benjamin Newton, who was a law student of her father's.
I have found a beautiful new friend, a gentle yet grave preceptor, teaching me what to read, what was most grand or beautiful in nature, and also that sublime lesson of faith in things unseen.
Newton recognized her potential as a poet, praised her early works, indeed urged her to become a poet, and introduced her to other poets like Ralph Emerson. Initially, her parents forbade her to write to Newton. They considered him a bad influence on her. But she didn't, and she held off writing to him for 3 whole weeks. And when the time was up, she wrote, "I shall." But he had then left Amherst, and he got married to an elder woman, and almost immediately he died. Emily was devastated. Her poems are never directly or simply autobiographical, but these 2 next poems surely refer to Newton.
I held a jewel in my fingers and went to sleep. The day was warm and winds were prosy. I said, "'Twill keep." I woke and chid my honest fingers. The gem was gone, and now an amethyst remembrance is all I own. Your riches taught me poverty, myself a millionaire in little wealths as girls could boast till broad as Buenos Aires. You drifted your dominions, a different Peru, and I esteemed all poverty for life's estate with you. Of mines I little know myself, but just the names of gems, the colours of the commonest, and scarce of diadems. So much that did I meet the queen, her glory I should know. But this must be a different wealth to miss it, beggars so. I'm sure 'tis India all day to those who look on you. Without a stint, without a blame, might I but be the Jew. I'm sure it is Golconda, beyond my power to deem, to have a smile for mine each day. How better than a gem? At least it solaces to know that there exists a gold, although I prove it just in time its distance to behold. It's far, far treasure to surmise and estimate the pearl that slipped my simple fingers through while just a girl at school.
With Newton gone, she met a man called the Reverend Charles Wadsworth. He was the pastor of the Arch Street Presbyterian Church in Philadelphia, and he was a famously charismatic preacher. She called him her heavenly father, the beloved clergyman, and her closest earthly friend. He was 40, she was only 23. But worse, from Emily's point of view, he was already married and happily married. And her relationship with him, though always close and was always spiritual and in her imagination, despite that, she lived in hope.
A wife at daybreak I shall be. Sunrise, hast thou a flag for me? At midnight I am but a maid. How short it takes to make a bride. Then midnight I have passed from thee under the east and victory. Midnight, good night, I hear them call, the angels bustle in the hall. Softly my future climbs the stair. I fumble at my childhood's prayer, so soon to be a child no more. Eternity, I'm coming, sir, saviour. I've seen the face before. Title divine is mine. The wife without the sign, acute degree conferred on me, Empress of Calvary. Royal all but the crown, betrothed without the swoon God sends us women, when you hold garnet to garnet, gold to gold, born, bridled, shrouded in a day, try victory. My husband, women say, stroking the melody. Is this the way?
As you can see, her poems really are passionate, describing her state of mind, if not her circumstances. Though Wadsworth was unattainable, she could and did dream of a life with him.
Wild nights, were I with thee, wild nights should be our luxury. Futile the winds to a heart in port, done with a compass, done with a chart, rowing in Eden. Ah, the sea, might I but moor tonight in thee. I gave myself to him and took himself for pay. The solemn contract of a life was ratified this way. The wealth might disappoint, myself a poorer prove than this great purchaser suspect. The daily own of love depreciate the vision, but till the merchant buy, still fable in the isles of spice, the subtle cargoes lie. At least 'tis mutual risk. Some found it mutual gain. Sweet debt of life. Each night we owe. Insolvent every noon. He put the belt around my life. I heard the buckle snap. And turned away, imperial, my lifetime folding up, deliberate as a duke would do, a kingdom's title deed. Oh, I think I've lost the second half of that one. Oh, well.
Oh, dear.
You get the gist. So sorry.
There came a day.
Anyway, here's one more. There came a day at summer's full entirely for me. I thought that such were for the saints, where resurrections be. The sun, as common, went abroad. The flowers accustomed blew, as if no soul the solstice passed that maketh all things new. This time was scarce profaned by speech. The symbol of a word was needless, as at sacrament. The wardrobe of our Lord. Each was to each the sealed church. Permitted to commune this time, lest we too awkward show at supper of the Lamb. The hours slid fast, as hours will, clutched tight by greedy hands. So faces on two decks look back, bound to opposing lands. And so when all the time had leaked, without external sound, each bound the other's crucifix. we gave no other bond. Sufficient troth that we shall rise, deposed at length the grave, to that new marriage, justified through Calvary's of love.
And then, out of the blue, a second disaster befell her, even more painful for her than the death of Newton. Wadsworth left Philadelphia to become a pastor in San Francisco.
My life closed twice before its close. It yet remains to see if immortality unveil a third event to me. So huge, so hopeless to conceive as these that twice befell. Parting is all we know of heaven, and all we need of hell. I never lost as much but twice, and that was in the sod. Twice have I stood a beggar before the door of God. Angels, twice descending, reimbursed my store. Burglar, banker, father, I am poor once more.
Wadsworth never returned to the East Coast during Emily's lifetime. That year, 1862, when she was 32, she began to withdraw from the world. Her poems became her life, writing 295 poems in the year 1863, a mere 98 in 64, and 229 in 1865.
After great pain, a formal feeling comes. The nerves sit ceremonious like tombs. The stiff heart questions, was it he that bore? And yesterday? Or centuries before? The feet mechanical go round of ground or air or aught. A wooden way, regardless grown, a quartz contentment like a stone. This is the hour of lead, remembered if outlived, as freezing persons recollect the snow, first chill, then stupor, then the letting go.
But despite this outpouring every year of poems, she still absolutely refused to publish, although she did begin to collect her poems, binding them in folders that she made herself that she called fascicles. I can't even say it, fascicles. But hiding them away.
Publication is the auction of the mind of man. Poverty be justifying for so foul a thing. Possibly, but we would rather from our garret go white under the white creator than invest our snow. Thought belonged to him who gave it, then to him who bare its corporeal illustration. Sell the royal heir in the parcel, be the merchant of the heavenly grace, but reduce no human spirit to disgrace of price.
The writing of her poetry became the absolute central fact of her life and her sole companion. That and household routine. She preferred baking to cleaning and had a great love of flowers and birds and observed the particular animals in minute detail. Here is a bird, a snake, a bee, and a fly.
A bird came down the walk. He did not know I saw. He bit an angel worm in halves and ate the fellow raw. And then he drank a dew from a convenient grass and then hopped sidewise to the wall to let a beetle pass. He glanced with rapid eyes that hurried all around. They looked like frightened beads, I thought. He stirred his velvet head like one in danger, cautious. I offered him a crumb, and he unrolled his feathers and rowed him softer home than oars divide the ocean. Too silver for a seam, or butterflies off banks of noon leap plashless as they swim. Snake poem. A narrow fellow in the grass occasionally rides. You may have met him, did you not? His notice sudden is. The grass divides as with a comb. A spotted shaft is seen, and then it closes at your feet and opens further on. He likes a boggy acre, a floor too cool for corn. Yet when a boy and barefoot, I more than once at noon have passed, I thought, a whiplash unbraiding in the sun. When stooping to secure it, it wrinkled and was gone. Several of nature's people I know, and they know me. I feel for them a transport of cordiality. But never met this fellow, attended or alone, without a tighter breathing and zero at the bone. B, I'm expecting you. Was saying yesterday to somebody you know that you were due. The frogs got home last week, are settled and at work. Birds mostly back, the clover warm and thick. You'll get my letter by the 17th. Reply, or better, be with me. Yours, Fly. I heard a fly buzz when I died. The stillness in the room was like the stillness in the air between the heaves of storm. The eyes around had wrung them dry, and breaths were gathering firm for that last onset when the king be witnessed in the room. I willed my keepsakes, signed away what portion of me be assignable, and then it was there interposed a fly with blue, uncertain, stumbling buzz between the light and me. And then the windows failed, and then I could not see to see.
And that, as you can appreciate, is just a small selection of her poems on animals. An extraordinary collection of natural history. Although she didn't publish, she did circulate poems among a select group of friends. The poet Helen Hunt Jackson, Samuel Bowles, who was the editor of a local paper called the Springfield Republican, and her close friend, very important in her life, Thomas Higginson, the editor of the Atlantic Monthly. Her poems are, as you can already hear and read, they're quite unlike those of any other mid-19th century poet. And at the time, they baffled people. Her friend, Dr. Josiah Gilbert Holland, wrote, "They really are not suitable. They are too ethereal." And when finally Higginson and her first editor, Mabel Loomis Todd, published her after her death, they altered her publication and diction in an attempt to make it more conventional and acceptable. Emily wrote in 1870,
"There is always one thing to be grateful for, that one is oneself and not somebody else."
She was not a total recluse, but she scarcely moved for the rest of her life from Amherst. She continued to see friends like the Hollands and her family, but she considered a chestnut tree better company than people, and she seldom left her room.
"I do not cross my father's ground to any house or town."
The popular image of Emily is this silent, reserved figure, always dressed in white, who kept life at arm's length so much that she insisted when she was ill that the doctor should diagnose her condition from the next door room. She said that she would walk back and to across the door and he could look at her through the open door. But such an image fails totally, all true that, but it fails to capture the inner turbulent Emily. Her poems continually contain violent images, volcanoes, guns.
A still volcano, life, that flickered in the night when it was dark enough to do without erasing sight. A quiet earthquake style, too subtle to suspect by nature's this side Naples. The north cannot detect the solemn, torrid symbol, the lips that never lie, whose hissing corals part and shut, and cities ooze away. My life had stood a loaded gun in corners till a day the owner passed, identified, and carried me away. And now we roam in sovereign woods, and now we hunt the doe, and every time I speak for him, the mountains straight reply. And do I smile, such cordial light upon the valley glow, it is as a Vesuvian face had let its pleasure through. And when, at night, our good day done, I guard my master's head, 'tis better than the eider duck's deep pillow to have shared. To foe of his, I'm deadly foe. None stir the second time, on whom I lay a yellow eye or an emphatic thumb. Though I than he may longer live, he longer must than I. For I have but the power to kill, without the power to die.
So you can see that she was very much more than just this ethereal figure in white that we tend often to think her of as such. And then an extraordinary event occurred, which had a terrific effect on the end of her life. Her brother, who was happily married to her best friend, Susan Gilbert, or apparently happily, he fell in love with somebody called Mabel Loomis Todd, the very beautiful, much younger wife of a visiting academic. And Emily, extraordinarily, given her nature and the way she'd been brought up, she became a party to their adultery. And despite her great friendship with, and indeed love for, his wife Susan, Emily allowed them to sleep together in her house.
He touched me, so I live to know that such a day, permitted so, I groped upon his breast. It was a boundless place to me, and silenced as the awful sea puts minor streams to rest. And now I'm different from before, as if I breathed superior air or brushed a royal gown. My feet, too, that had wandered so, my gypsy face, transfigured now to tenderer renown. Into this port, if I might come, Rebecca to Jerusalem would not so ravished turn, nor Persian, baffled at her shrine, lift such a crucifixial sign to her imperial son.
Curiously, her main biographers over the last 100 years, George Whitcher and Alfred Habiger, totally failed to recognise the importance or the significance or the existence of this affair of Austin, her brother, and the effect that it had on Emily. But it's been put right by a more recent biography by Lyndall Gordon, that does chart this extraordinary relationship with Todd. But in 1874, her beloved father, Edward, died. And then in 1881, Dr. Holland, a great friend of hers, and he was followed by than poet Helen Hunt Jackson in 1883. Although Emily was only 55, she felt her life was coming to an end. She had bad bronchial problems always.
The last night that she lived, it was a common night, except the dying. This to us made nature different. We noticed smallest things, things overlooked before by this great light upon our minds, italicized, as it were. As we went out and in between her final room and rooms where those to be alive tomorrow were, a blame that others could exist while she must finish, quite a jealousy for her arose, so nearly infinite. We waited while she passed. It was a narrow time. Too jostled were our souls to speak. At length the notice came. She mentioned and forgot, then lightly as a reed bent to the water, struggled scarce, consented, and was dead. And we placed the hair and drew the head erect. And then an awful leisure was, belief to regulate. Because I could not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me. The carriage held but just ourselves and immortality. We slowly drove, he knew no haste, and I had put away my labour and my leisure too for his civility. We passed the school where children strove at recess in the ring. We passed the fields of gazing grain. We passed the setting sun, or rather he passed us. The dews drew quivering and chill, for only gossamer my gown, my tippet only tulle. We paused before a house that seemed a swelling of the ground. The roof was scarcely visible, the cornice in the ground. Since then, 'tis centuries, and yet feels shorter than the day I first surmised the horses' heads were towards eternity. I died for beauty, but was scarce adjusted in the tomb when one who died for truth was lain in an adjoining room. He questioned softly why I failed. For beauty, I replied, and I for truth. Themselves are one, we brethren are, he said. And so, as kinsmen, met a night, we talked between the rooms until the moss had reached our lips and covered up our names.
Amazing, isn't it? Her health got worse and worse. She found it increasingly difficult to breathe. She spoke of the great intrusion of death. Some gardens, she observed, were willing to die in autumn.
I do not think mine was. It perished with beautiful reluctance, like an evening star.
Emily Dickinson died on 15th of May, 1886, aged 55. After her death, Lavinia, her sister, discovered this huge cache of fascicles, of her cache of poems in her room. They were published in 1890 by Higginson, her old friend, and, well, surprisingly, by Mabel Loomis Todd. They, as I said, tidied up her syntax in balderized form. Her reputation in the subsequent years was promoted by her niece, Martha Dickinson Bianchi, who inherited the homestead, this great house on Main Street, and whose books promoted the image that we have today of Emily, dressed in white, reclusive. Later in the 20th century, writers such as George Wycher and Alfred Heberger, if you're interested in reading about more about her, they're very solid, good, respectable things. You get them in the library. But much more recently, Lyndall Gordon has offered a more balanced feminist view even. Though I'm pretty certain that Emily Dickinson would have deplored the idea of herself being a feminist, not unknown to herself. I think that we should leave the last... Do go and read Lyndall Gordon if you've got it. It's in paperback now, and it's an extraordinary read. And she charts this amazing affair between her brother and Loomis Todd. But I think we should leave the last word to Emily, or other two poems from Emily that I think say it all.
Tell all the truth, but tell it slant. Success in circuit lies, too bright for our infirm delight, the truth's superb surprise. As lightning to the children eased with explanation kind, the truth must dazzle gradually, or every man be blind. The heart asks pleasure first, and then excuse from pain, and then those little anodynes that deaden suffering, and then to go to sleep, and then, if it should be the will of its inquisitor, the privilege to die.
Well, there's no shortage of poems. There are another 1,700 poems that you can read. But she really is worth it, and I hope you've enjoyed that.